Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
When I was a kid, I loved this question, and I often stumped people with it. What is the only day of the year that is a command? That's March 4th. And why is that date important for you, March 4th, 2021? That is the first day of our next LNC virtual conference. My name is Pat Iyer, and with Barbara Levin, we've planned 3 days of interactivity, knowledge, and fun. This is a conference that is focused right now on helping you look at your practice and say, what shifts do you continue to need to make? What is current? What are the types of cases that are likely to be strong? How does that affect the cases that are being mediated and settled? What do you need to do in your practice to incorporate current business practices and create deeper connections with your clients? We have the answers through a panel of attorneys and legal nurse consultants and business experts. Be sure to sign up for this conference, March 4th, 5th, and 6th, 2021. I know that may seem like it's far away, but it's not. It's coming up soon. Be sure to reserve your spot by going to this link, lnc.tips/March 2021 virtual. I'll see you there.
Hey, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have the pleasure of bringing to you today an OB nurse with extensive experience, 35 years, in the maternal child health arena. She has been a bedside nurse, a clinical specialist, a nurse manager, and an educator, all in the area of obstetrical health. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thank you so much for having me, Pat. So I want to start by telling you, how did I get into this area? So 46 years ago, I had a baby. I was young, all my friends were in college, and here I was having a baby. And he ended up spending 7.5 months in the hospital. Little did I know that that ever happened to anybody, but I learned very quickly that it was the nurses that made my son's stay what it was. And I realized that they were the ones who every day helped me and my family navigate this experience. They got to know him better than me, because back in those days, we didn't have rooming in and staying with your baby all the time. And they got to know him and who he was and who I was. And I realized after 7.5 months that I needed to repay and dedicate myself to families and mothers and babies. And so that's how I came to enter the area of maternal child health, become a family clinical nurse specialist, and dedicate my career to improving the lives of mothers and babies. So here I am many years later with a 46-year-old son who, thank goodness, is healthy and made me a grandmother a couple of times over. So that's how I got to become the maternal child nurse that I am, and very grateful for all those nurses that took care of him.
So. We have in common that we had our firstborn child have problems at birth. My oldest son was premature and spent 3 weeks in the hospital before coming home. And I wrote an article called My Baby is Premature that was published by the Journal of Obstetrical and Gynecological Nurses, JOGN.
Yes.
And that gave me an outlet to talk from the perspective of being a nurse and a mother about some of the experiences that I went through. And my son is now 45. He was born in 1976, right? So that would make him probably 46, right?
Yeah, so this was in 1974, and there were no NICUs in New Jersey. So 6 days a week, I drove to New York, and it was very different. And we've come a long way in care of our NICU babies. But those nurses, as I said, they were my lifeline. And so I understood the impact that we nurses can make on the outcome of families. And so that's how I came to be where I am today and choose the specialty that means so much to me.
Well, let's shift our focus for you and I both had positive outcomes with children who were healthy and survived that difficult beginning. Legal nurse consultants are brought into situations where the outcomes are not so positive.
And that's correct.
And they turn to people like you as an expert witness to help them with their cases. I wanted to be sure I gave your full name because I referred to you as Ellen, but your full name is Ellen Hahn, H-A-H-N.
That's right.
Ellen, I know you've been, as an expert witness, looked at many obstetrical cases. What are the most common types of cases that you've encountered?
So I think the most common issues that we see are issues with fetal monitoring tracing, hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, and hemorrhage. And those are the three areas that I see as overriding issues in the cases that are presented to me. We have to remember in all obstetrical cases that there's two patients. There's the mother and there's the either the fetus or the newborn baby. So every case has that added dimension of looking at the outcome for the mother and the newborn.
And I know that fetal monitoring strips are critical in terms of being able to provide information about what is going on with that fetus. Can you give us some tips about what to do if you're a legal nurse consultant and you get an OB case in your door and there are fetal monitoring strips? First of all, should somebody who's not an OB nurse be involved in screening that case, or are there alternatives?
Well, I would say that if you're not an OB nurse and you are presented with a case that involves interpretation of a fetal monitor strip, you should consult with someone that has experience with interpreting those strips, because you're going to get the record that's going to have the nurse's notes that are going to be showing documentation of what the nurse interpreted the strip as and then what her interventions were. And so it's going to be critical that you look at each of there are many elements of the fetal monitor strip that are included. And those include the baseline of the fetal heart rate, the variability, which is a very critical element. The variability is the fluctuation of the fetus's heart rate. And that tells what I call how much reserve, or what does the fetus have in its backpack? And that will give you an indication of how much reserve the fetus has moving forward. Then we look for accelerations, which are increases in the baby's heart rate, and then decelerations. And those decelerations are indicative of distress or not. And this is all related to uterine activity. So that's the other element, is that we want to look at how many uterine contractions there are. And then how is the fetus reacting? Because remember, when the uterus contracts, that means that there's a decrease of blood flow and then oxygen to the fetus. So all of those elements have to be looked at as a whole picture, and a whole picture over time. So I would say that if you're the legal nurse consultant who can read the medical record but cannot read the fetal monitor strip, it would kind of be like me looking at a critical care document and reading what the CCU nurse or the ICU nurse wrote, but then getting Swan Gan readings and not understanding what those meant. So you need someone to look at the whole picture. So I think that there would be elements that would be missing if you got the fetal monitor strip and really didn't know what you were looking at.
I have encountered people who are certified in electronic fetal monitoring skills. What does that certification mean? And is that the kind of person that a legal nurse consultant should consult with? Or can you be skilled in interpreting fetal monitoring strips without being certified?
I believe that you can. I happen to have that certification, and I also teach. I'm an A1 fetal monitor instructor. What's involved is studying for an exam and sitting for it, and then every 3 years having taking 15 credits of continuing education. I also have a certification in inpatient obstetrics, which requires me to take 45 credits every 3 years in various areas of inpatient obstetrical nursing, antepartum training, and postpartum and newborn assessment. I think it just speaks to, like any certification, keeping your skills ongoing. But the electronic fetal monitoring certification is specifically in fetal monitoring. I think if you're an experienced obstetrical nurse and you're used to reading strips all the time, then you have enough experience to do it without that certification, but it's just an added credential.
Mm-hmm. Anything else related to fetal monitoring strips that you wanted to cover before I ask you about another aspect of OB?
So I think what's important is that that nurses, when you're looking at a case and there are issues with the strip, to see if the nurse did correct interventions, because depending on what's going on with the fetus, did she do the, he or she rather, do the correct interventions, and did she report them to the physician? I think that's what's critical. Did she document correctly? Did she recognize the issue? And did she report it correctly? And I think that's what's essential for the nurse to examine in the medical record.
I know that when there are concerning signs, and I know the term late decels is a concerning sign, that people are really pressured to make a fast decision about what to do to try to get that baby out. And this concept of 30 minutes from decision to incision, I have heard, is that the standard of care? And if it is, how do you accomplish that in an acute care facility with all of the pieces that have to go into place for that to be accomplished?
So those are standards that are set by ACOG, for 30 minutes for incision to decisions, from decision to incision. So a STAP section means that you have even less time. If a cesarean section is called STAT, you go immediately. Most facilities have ORs that are set to go. And if it's a truly STAT situation, you can even do it at the bedside. So if it's a STAP, that means that you just go immediately. An urgent is 30 minutes decision to incision. And so the physician has to be at the bedside. It can't be that the nurse has called and said, we're having repetitive late decelerations. He says, I'm on my way, get the room ready. He must be present at the bedside to call it at that moment. And you certainly can accomplish it. You would have your OR team ready. you would call your NICU team. And certainly that can be accomplished in 30 minutes, or it should be. You should be in a facility that has an OR team ready, and you can always call the main OR, but you should, those are criteria that are set by ACOG, by the American College of Gynecologists. So that's 30 minutes from incision when the physician is present to incision. And then to follow means, you know, we'd like to get it done as soon as possible, but late decelerations are one piece of the puzzle. You would do interventions in the meantime, turning your patient, if Pitocin is running, you would turn it off. You would give the mother oxygen. And I want to note, in this time of COVID, oxygen is kind of a little bit of a conundrum, because we're using oxygen much more judiciously because of that danger of aerosolization. So oxygen is only used for maternal desaturations, not so much for fetal. But we are turning, we're turning Pitocin off, we're doing other things to see if we can improve those late decelerations, repositioning, et cetera, and seeing if we can improve the strip in the meantime. But there are other, there are variable decelerations which come from compression on the umbilical cord, and sometime we can improve those with our interventions. We can increase our IV fluids and rehydrate and see if we can improve things like that. We can give some tributyline to see if we can decrease the uterine contractions in the meantime and relax the uterus. And sometime we get some good results in the meantime while we're waiting. Sometimes the patient can even start pushing in the meantime if she's fully dilated, and see if we can affect a vaginal delivery.
I know you've mentioned Pitocin a couple of times. What are the nurse's responsibilities related to giving that medication?
So Pitocin or oxytocin is one of the most common used drugs in our labor and delivery setting. So it always has to be run as a secondary line. You always have to have a main line running, and you have to increase it very slowly, depending on your guidelines. And the goal is to have contractions every 2 to 3 minutes apart, because the fetus needs time to recover after each contraction. So when the contraction is occurring, there is that squeeze of the uterus, which decreases blood flow and therefore oxygen to the fetus. And you don't want to have too many contractions. The term tachysystole is more than 5 contractions in a 10-minute window over 30 minutes, because we're always looking at the fetal monitor strip as a work in progress. And so we're always looking at the picture of the fetal monitor strip over time. So we don't want more than 5 contractions over 10 minutes, because then the fetus doesn't have time to recover and kind of have that rest. So the objective is to have contractions every 2 to 3 minutes apart. So the nurse has to be aware of the fact of how much Pitocin she uses, remembering also that when a woman is in labor, she's producing her own natural oxytocin, which is produced from the pituitary gland. And she may just need a very small amount to get those contractions going on her own. If she does give oxygen, the guidelines say that the Pitocin should go off, because if you need to do an intervention to improve the fetal monitor strip, you don't want to continue with the medication that may be causing the problem in the first place. Mm-hmm. So if you're using one, then you have to turn the other off and then start again once you've improved or, you know, gotten the problem under focus. Mm-hmm. Then Pitocin is used after delivery to make sure that the uterus stays contracted, and Pitocin is then used in the postpartum period as well.
And speaking of the postpartum period, I think from a liability perspective and a damages perspective?
Yes.
A woman who hemorrhages after delivery poses a huge clinical challenge. And if she dies, it's a huge legal challenge. You know, the baby is valuable, and there's damages associated with infants who never survive delivery. But when a woman dies who is in her 20s or 30s, the legal system provides so much more attention and compensation for the loss of a woman. Tell us what leads to women dying, because I still hear it happening, and it's something that strikes terror into the hearts of families and into defense attorneys when a case like that arises.
So hemorrhage is still considered one of the leading causes of maternal death. And we classify hemorrhage for a vaginal delivery as greater than 500 mLs of blood, and for a cesarean section as greater than 1,000 mLs. And the most important point that I can drive home is that blood loss has to be quantified. We used to estimate blood loss, but nursing research actually came to show that we greatly underestimate blood loss. That if we give you something and say, how much is this? We greatly underestimate how much blood loss there is. So everything has to get weighed or quantified in this. In the OR, we look at the canisters of blood. We weigh every single lap pad and sponge that is saturated with blood. We know how much it weighs dry and then how much it weighs wet, and we subtract those amounts. In a vaginal delivery, there's a pad that goes under the woman, and it's graduated, so we can see how much blood there is in there minus the amniotic fluid. And there's very sophisticated methods of weighing everything, so we know how much blood loss there is. Mm-hmm. And then after the delivery, if a woman delivers at 3 o'clock and she goes to the postpartum area, and then an hour or so later, her bed is saturated with blood and we press on her fundus and she starts bleeding again, that blood loss is added to the cumulative total, and we start seeing what's going on with her. In either vaginal or cesarean section, the reasons for blood loss are atony, so the uterus isn't contracting well. There can be retained products, so those we'd have to go in and see if there's any fragments of placenta that have been left behind that continue bleeding. There can be a tear, some kind of little bleeder, if there was a vaginal delivery that hasn't been repaired, that the physician might have to go in and repair. Or there can be some kind of bleeding disorder, some kind of blood dyscrasia that's causing a bleeding disorder. And this can happen in a vaginal delivery or in a cesarean section. And so then we use Pitocin, we use Methergin, we use Hemabate, there's a whole cascade of medications that are used to get the bleeding under control. But these are not uncommon situations that happen. And as you say, to lose a woman to a hemorrhage is a very unfortunate situation. We also have, as we all learned in nursing school, the difference between placenta previa, which is that bright red painless bleeding, and a placental abruption, which is a premature separation of the placenta from the uterus, which is that board-like rigid abdomen, which can cause bleeding either dark red or it's hidden in a separation, which can cause fetal distress or loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the big issue is that the blood loss is quantified.
So with that in mind, can you comment on the nursing standards of care regarding observing for bleeding postpartum?
Yes. So after a vaginal delivery, nursing care is one-to-one for the first 2 hours, and the nurse assesses the mom every 15 minutes, doing fundal checks, doing pad checks, and observing for bleeding. For the first hour, we usually have one nurse for the baby and one nurse for the mother, and then for the second hour, usually it's a couplet care kind of situation. We encourage skin-to-skin care, where the baby is placed on the mother's skin right away. What that encourages is many things. It helps the uterus contract right away and helps control bleeding. It encourages breastfeeding. It actually helps mother's vital signs stabilize right away. For the newborn, it thermoregulates. It helps regulate baby's blood sugar right away. It encourages breastfeeding to start as soon as possible, and we certainly encourage breastfeeding right away, but it helps bonding, of course, right away. So we hope to take the baby as soon as it's born, put it right skin to skin, dry the baby off, do our Apgar assessments, do everything on the newborn, keep them together, take them off briefly to weigh the baby, and then give it right back to mom for those first 2 hours. And encourage breastfeeding, which will help the uterus stay contracted. And so there's a first 2 hour window. If there's a cesarean section, the standards in the PACU would be the same as any other standards for any other surgery, of every 5 minutes for the first 15 and then every 15, et cetera, and watching for bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we would be watching for. And then in the immediate postpartum period, on the mother-baby unit, would be the same kind of standards.
Well, there's so many questions that I could ask you, Ellen, and we're reaching the end of our time. What are some of the common themes that you have seen in the factors that lead to poor obstetrical outcomes?
I think what I see the most often is either lack of or late communication with the physician. I think nurses either do their interventions and don't report, or they don't do their interventions and report too late. I think there is a lack of communication or a lack of use of chain of command. And we know from, not just from obstetrical situations, but any situation the Joint Commission cites, that the biggest risk for injury is poor communication. And time and again, I see nurses not communicating their concerns about fetal monitor strips, or we didn't have a chance to talk about hypertensive disorders, but issues with blood pressure and patients who have borderline high blood pressures, and there's concerns with that, and they're not communicating well with the physicians, and physicians are sending patients home, and then they're returning to the hospital much sicker, either with eclamptic seizures or with abruptions and babies that are not doing well. And nurses didn't communicate their concerns with their physicians, or going to their managers or directors and saying, look, I don't feel right about sending this patient home, or I think the labetalol is not enough and we need to do something more. And the nurse, as we talked about earlier, the nurses are the ones who are getting to know these patients so intimately and knowing better what's going on with them, and not communicating well enough or soon enough. And I think either with the fetal monitor strip or with blood pressure issues, I think that's what I'm seeing as a concern. Whenever I look at a case before I even start, I'm always hoping that the nurse has done her due diligence and used, you know, practice to the standard of care that she should. And often I do, and sometime I wish you, you know, they had done better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's so much at stake, Ellen, in terms of following the standard of care. I'm sure our listener is aware of the huge verdicts that can be rendered in a case of an infant who survives, but with some anoxic brain damage or, you know, so many tragic cases that can evolve from things going wrong during that critical part of the pregnancy.
Yes, yes. And so much also depends on where in the gestation they are. You know, are we talking about a 24-week delivery or a 30-week delivery or a term baby? And often you know, is it a baby that does survive with deficits, or is it a stillbirth, or, you know, as we talked about, are we losing a mom? And so it's, you know, each case has its individual, you know, pitfalls, but I think nurses need to be very diligent about communicating with their physician and then documenting. You know, did the physician respond? Did he or she come to the bedside? What was their response? And being very, very detailed about the response. And mm-hmm. I think if they do that, then they're doing what they need to do for the benefit of the mother and the baby.
We mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that you review cases as an expert witness. Can you share how people can get in touch with you if they have a need to discuss you or your services?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn, and my email is ellenrnc@yahoo.com, and I'm a member of the listserv of the AALNC, the American Association of Legal Nurse Consultants, and I'm very happy to chat with anybody. Just my time is available to you if you just want to chat about a case, if you want to pick my brain. I'm very happy to do that. Those are my ways of getting in touch with me for now. And I'm always open to giving you my thoughts and just chatting with you about certain things and giving you information and some links about how to find information about fetal monitoring or about hypertensive disorders, and just giving you some clues and some direction on information that you need for your case.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ellen. That is a wonderful way to connect with you, through your LinkedIn profile, through your email address. Thank you to you for being part of the show. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me, Pat. I really enjoyed being here today.
And thank you to you who has been watching this show on our YouTube channel, which is Legal Nurse Business, or listening to it on the audio platforms. We bring you a new interview, a new person to share wisdom with you as the listener. Be sure to come back next week, or if you are listening to several shows in a row, go on to the next show and be sure to tell your LNC colleagues about Legal Nurse Podcast. We are now in our fifth year of production as a Legal Nurse Consulting specific podcast, and we appreciate your comments and the wonderful things that you say about the value of this show. Thanks so much. Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have just finished interviewing Dr. Diane Krasner, who is a nurse and a wound care expert and has been doing expert witness work for 15 years. Diane, we've just had an extensive conversation. Let's tell our listener, what are the key points that he or she is going to get from the podcast that we just completed?
So we had a great discussion about how to begin a career as an expert, what resources are available, and what pathways you might choose to explore if you're going to start expert work. We talked about some of the challenges of keeping current as an expert and assuring that you meet the criteria for an expert in a particular state. And then we also talked about the how to balance staying an expert with your career as an expert witness and how the two can dovetail in a way, and how in my particular case, the income that I get from my expert work helps me to continue and perpetuate my academic work. And the two reflect and contribute to one another. So we also talked a little bit about the differences between experts that are very focused, like I have been in my career, and experts that are more general, like Pat was in her expert career. So lots of interesting discussion that I think you will find very useful.
Well, thank you, Diane. And thank you to you who has been listening to this little segment. Be sure to check out Diane's podcast with Legal Nurse Podcast. Thanks so much.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.